May it please the Court, Timothy Langella arguing on behalf of the appellees, HSBC Bank as the paying agent, and the City and County of Denver, which is the landlord of the property. You just heard counsel for United tell you why this lease transaction is just like the situation in SFO. Well, it's not, and it's not for a number of reasons. We've set forth those reasons in detail in our written submissions, but there are three things I'd like to talk about and emphasize with you today. First, this case is different from the other three cases that you have considered or will be considering because it doesn't involve a lease-leaseback situation where United used an existing asset to secure credit and will get that asset back at the end of the sublease. It's a single lease structure which governs both the land and the facilities that are an integral part of the property that United uses on a daily basis for its ongoing operations. And because of the above, it's not only distinguishable from the leaseback situations of the other three cases, it's remarkably indistinguishable from the typical tenant build-out true leases that you see routinely in the commercial world. The second point I want to talk about is that the Denver lease is a true lease under applicable Colorado law because Denver, the landlord, unquestionably has a substantial reversionary interest at the end of the lease term. And the third point that I'd like to talk with you is, regardless of whether you find some aspects or some terms of the Denver lease to be financing-related terms, as United would have you believe, you have already stated in your San Francisco decision that you do not doubt that many financing devices are true leases. And given that, there is nothing in this lease, there is nothing under Colorado law, and there's nothing in the bankruptcy code that would allow any so-called financing terms to be separated out from the rest of the lease.
In the event of a default and the city is the landlord, maybe this is hypothetical, but default, so you're out of here, does then the city obligated to take over the bond payments?
The city, under the structure that was negotiated with the bondholders, has pledged the revenues from those facility rentals as payment. And so if the city defaults United, which it can do for any type, in other words, if it doesn't pay the ground rent, right, if it doesn't pay the facilities rent, or it doesn't pay the additional rent that all leases have, it can kick United out of everything. It's governed by, they use the term leased property, which covers both the ground and the facilities. If that happens, the city of Denver, when it goes to release the property to somebody else, the revenues that come in from those properties get, because they've been pledged, get to pay off the debt that the city of Denver took out with the bondholders. Now, let me address the first issue, why the Denver lease is different from the situations presented in the other cases, and why the Denver lease has all the characteristics of a true lease. First, this was an original lease that set forth in a separate document structure. It governs both the ground and the facilities on that ground. It's not a lease-leaseback structure. It's not a sale-leaseback structure. And those are the types of structures that you see all the time when you're doing these types of recharacterizations. These are important factors because that means United held no interest in the underlying property that's the subject of the lease prior to the time the lease was signed. United did not use an existing asset to secure an extension of credit. Now, the primary lease has the characteristics of a true lease because it addresses the property that's being rented. It addresses the ground, it addresses the facilities, and it defines both the ground and the facilities as the leased property. The lease addresses the obligations that must be met to use that leased property. Under Section 6, they have to pay ground rent, they have to pay facilities rent, and they have to pay additional rent. And while counsel for United said that they make the facility rental payments directly to the paying agent, it's in the lease, if you look at the language, it says that those payments are made on account of the city. And that's because it's the city that took out the debt, not United. The lease contains default and remedy provisions. These are in sections 1.1 and 1.2. And as I just said before, if there is a default on any aspect of the lease, the city of Denver, like any true landlord, can kick United out and recapture possession of the entire leased premises.
What do you mean when you say the city took out the debt or whatever it
is? It was the city that issued the bonds. A bond is a debt instrument, and it was the city that issued them.
Well, that got the tax-exempt feature in it.
That's what happens with
it. I mean, that was the whole point of that, to try to put it through this, whatever you want to call it, in order to get the tax exemption, but without casting liability on the city. Now, as you point out, if another tenant took over in the case of eviction, then that tenant, I guess, what do you call it, rent, would go directly to the trustee, at least to the extent of paying off the bonds.
Okay. And if I could just explain, the United would have you believe that these are non-recourse bonds. They're not non-recourse. They're limited recourse. And they're limited to the pledged assets or the pledged rentals, which are the facility rentals.
That's what non-recourse means.
Well, I think
collection is limited to the pledged asset.
That's a limited recourse. That's not non-recourse. If they're limited to a particular, just like in a commercial lease, you can have the
exactly
owner of a building.
That's exactly what non-recourse means in the commercial world. I don't think quibbling gets you very far here.
I agree. Now, the lease contains numerous provisions that address the rights, duties, and obligations of both the landlord and the tenant with respect to the leased property. That is, with respect to both the ground and the facilities. For example, there are provisions on the tenant's access to the leased property, the tenant's surrendering of the leased property, the landlord's rendering quiet enjoyment rights with respect to the leased property, and it goes on and on. There are over 70 provisions.
That's a wonderful term to use in conjunction with an airport. Quiet enjoyment is not what anybody gets.
They get to use it peacefully. I think it's peaceful and quiet enjoyment.
Fine.
Now, most importantly for true lease analysis, though, the lease itself contains provisions that ensure that the landlord will get its property back at the end of the lease term with substantial value remaining. That's shown through provisions 4.3, 5.2, and 8.10. This lease document is so much of a true lease that United even subleased a portion of it, of the facilities, that is the flight kitchen, under a structure that mirrors the same lease structure that the City of Denver has with it. Now, given these characteristics, the lease is a true lease under Colorado law. Lease finance and its progeny identify seven factors that a court may look to. The first two are essentially ownership markers, whether the lessee has an option to purchase at a nominal amount, which United doesn't, whether the lessee acquires any equity in the asset, which United doesn't. And these are just the flip side of the fact that in a true lease situation, a landlord or a true landlord has a substantial reversionary interest. All the other factors, the five other factors that the Colorado courts look to, relate to negotiated commercial terms that may or may not indicate ownership in one side or the other. For example, who pays the taxes, who pays the insurance.
Is there a lump sum obligation at the end of the term?
In this particular lease, yes, there is.
Well, what does that indicate?
I think in this case, the airport is on a cost structure basis. In other words, it's a cost recovery situation. The airport can't make a profit. And the type of debt that the airport took out with its lender is one that the interest payments get paid on a yearly basis, semi-yearly basis. And at the end of the term of the financing that the landlord took out, there is the balloon payment. That structure was passed on to the tenant. And I think, in that situation, it had to do that because the airport can't make a profit. It wouldn't be able to charge the tenant anything else other than what its own obligation was for that.
What do they call that nine-year extension when there's an amount over the amount due on the bonds?
Well, in this case, at the end of the 31 years, the original term of the lease, there is that at that point in time, the airport gets what its profit is from this particular transaction. It gets the facilities with at least 20% of its original value still intact. And if there's going to be the extension for the next 9 years, that's an asset that is now owned by the airport, and the airport has the right to charge rent for the remaining 9 years that asset then ends up, the value of it gets sort of depleted because it's being used for another 9 years.
Well, that's not offensive to whatever you just said about the city can't make a profit then.
No, I think it's not, because if there is an extension, then the bonds, the airport doesn't have to pay back the bonds. The bonds can be carried for another 9 years too, so that it's
interest.
40. Yeah, so that the interest payments can be paid for the 40 years. So at that point in time, the airport has to both make sure that the bonds are paid and make sure it, at that point, recaptures its profit through that extra 9 year rental payment. Now, the initial two factors that the Colorado courts look at are weighed more heavily, and it makes sense given that the object in a true lease analysis is to determine whether the owner has actually leased the property or essentially sold it and financed the underlying transaction. The courts in Colorado have found a true lease to exist even with some or all of the other five factors present. That happened in the lease finance case. That happened in what I call the DISCO case. It's the DSCO. I don't know how you pronounce it, but that's how I pronounce it. Now, the test or the factors that they use are consistent with Colorado's Uniform Commercial Code, and quite frankly, it's consistent with the application of UCC principles throughout the country. The fact that the difference between a true lease and a security transaction is almost all the cases that deal with this issue. They say it lies in whether the lessee acquires an equity of ownership through his rent payments, and in this case, the United doesn't. When the Colorado factors are applied to this case, you'll see that United has conceded the first two. They have no ownership interests, and Denver has a substantial reversionary interest. The other factors don't really help United because they show less the character of the transaction and more just the results of commercial negotiation. Therefore, under Colorado law, this lease that you're dealing with here is a true lease. To help bolster this, we've cited to you two typical tenant build-out cases, Westship and In Re Cafe Partners, to show that this issue has been dealt with other courts. I know it's not binding on this court, but I think it can be instructive to see that this is not a case of first impression in the country. It may be a case of first impression for this circuit, but other courts have considered the same types of arguments that United is making, and they have refused to sever and they have refused to recharacterize. In terms of the true lease analysis, I would like to say that it's very important to make note of the fact that United has failed to cite a single case where a court has recharacterized a lease into a disguised financing when the landlord retained a substantial reversionary interest like Denver holds here. That should hold true, especially since in this case United admits that it holds no equity in the property, it holds no option to purchase the property,
doesn't hold any equity in the land. But the thing that's interesting about this transaction is that when the bonds are paid off, United will own the terminal. Is that correct?
No. United owns nothing when the bonds are paid off.
United owns nothing when the bonds are paid off.
The airport owns everything.
So United is doing all of this as a favor to the airport?
No, United wanted to use the land at the airport and wanted to be able to use facilities, and so it entered into a lease that allowed the lease to be improved, and it agreed to, through its rental stream, help pay for those improvements, just like any tenant build-out case that you see in the commercial world. Now, if I can...
They essentially just have a leasehold interest, whatever, I guess, for that period of time. Is that the only real asset that they have, the United, as far as those facilities are concerned?
When they entered in... The day before they entered into the lease, they had no interest. When they entered into the lease, on the day they entered in 1992, that's when they obtained their interest. And their interest was in the ground at that point and the improved facilities. That's right.
And they had to, but in building the facilities, that's what all this money is for, obviously, is to build the facilities, right?
Just like when the federal government built this courthouse, somebody had to take the money to build the benches and the
nobody takes credit for this, I might add.
Okay. Now, United's whole argument, as the court noted, seems to rest on the severability issue. And as the court correctly noted, that's a state court issue. Both parties agree state law issue. Both parties agree and have agreed all along that Colorado law applies. Now, under Colorado law, a contract cannot be severed unless the language of the contract manifests each party's intent to treat the contract as divisible. That's the Univex versus Oryx Credit Alliance case. decided by the Colorado Supreme Court in 1996, and almost 20 years earlier in John versus United Advertising, the Supreme Court put it another way, and they used the test whether the parties assented to all the promises as a single whole, so that there would have been no bargain whatsoever if any promise or set of promises were struck out. Both courts below rejected United's severability argument. The bankruptcy court found, quote, nothing in the Denver lease manifests an intent either by the City of Denver or by United to treat the lease as divisible into separate ground lease and financing components. The district court found that the plain language of the lease demonstrates that the parties did not intend the lease to be divisible. Those findings are correct based on the plain language of the lease and the other evidence in this record. United and Denver agreed to all the promises as a single whole, not to separate divisible obligations. Now, the plain language of the lease manifests the party's intent to agree to one interrelated contract, one that conditions United's right to use and occupy the leased property on its agreement to pay all of the rentals due, including the facility rentals. That's in Section 6. The default provisions of Section 11.1 and the remedies on default provision in Section 11.2 make no distinction between the ground and the facility rentals. If United fails to pay on either, the landlord has the right to evict United from the leased property, that is, from both the ground and the facilities. The default provision is not the only place where the parties used the term leased premises. The agreements replete with provisions that express or condition rights, duties, or obligations with respect to the leased property. In fact, there are over 70 references to the term leased property in this document. These provisions clearly show an intent by the parties to intertwine their respective rights, duties, and obligations. Now, the evidence gathered during discovery during the bankruptcy case, which we have put a lot of it in the supplemental appendix, there are a number of admissions by United. There's testimony of witnesses and depositions, and there's an affidavit from the bond counsel who negotiated on behalf of the City of Denver. All of that evidence uncontrovertibly shows that the parties purposefully created a single indivisible lease with interrelated provisions concerning all aspects of the leased property. In fact, I think if you check the supplemental record, United agreed that it wouldn't have leased the ground if it couldn't have also leased the facilities, and the City of Denver, their witness said, the City of Denver would never have leased the ground to United unless United also leased facilities, and they wouldn't have entered into this lease if they couldn't kick them out of both for the failure to pay any of the rentals.
Now, this United entered into this before the facilities were built, weren't they?
That's right.
And so all this, and then you have this, the separate payments, facilities rentals and ground rentals. That's probably the thing that I looked at is questioning why this isn't naturally separated, because the clearly the facilities rentals, so called, are to pay off the bonds, and that's it.
Well, I don't think they're to pay off the bonds. I think they're to pay for the use of...
There may be other things, but it's all part of that, isn't it? It's completely separate from the rent, the ground lease.
I don't think it is. I think the rental payments are set forth in Section 6 of the lease. Section 6 says rental obligations. And under the rental obligations, there are a number of aspects of it, just like you'd have in a regular lease. If you looked at any commercial lease, you have the rental payments, you have additional rental payments, you have other things that are included. It's not unusual in a lease, in a commercial lease, to have a number of elements to the rental payments, and that's what the parties did here. Now, in this case, they called one aspect of them facilities rentals. I don't think that means that it's separable. Now, I would ask the court in conclusion to affirm the district court's decision. Here we have a true lease. Denver owns the lease property, both the ground and the facilities. Denver has a substantial reversionary interest, and United has no equity and will not use up the equity of the lease property during the lease term. This case is fundamentally different from San Francisco and the other two cases. It's a single lease structure that governs both the land and the facilities that are an integral part of the property that United uses on a daily basis for its operations. It's not a lease-leaseback situation like the other transactions. United did not use an existing asset to secure an extension of credit. It's a typical tenant build-out lease like those that happen every day in the commercial world. There is nothing in the lease, there's nothing under Colorado law, and there's nothing in the bankruptcy code that would allow any financial terms to be severed or separated out from the rest of the lease. Therefore, United must assume or reject the lease in whole as the bankruptcy code requires. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Yes. Your Honor, I just want to touch on a few points that counsel raised. First, Your Honor, in talking about the lease finance factors, counsel asserts that there's the first two factors, the ownership factor, so-called, are more heavily weighted under Colorado law. But if you review the cases that he cites, that is not, in fact, the case. There's no authority for the proposition that those are weighted more heavily. And, in fact, the ownership factors, as we all know in the airport situation, cannot be dispositive, because if they were dispositive here, they would have been dispositive in San Francisco. United has not, cannot, and will not own any airport property, barring a change in the statutory framework that would permit an airline to own airport facilities. That's not simply not the way it works. It didn't work that way in San Francisco. With respect to the city's reversionary interest, which a lot of emphasis has been put on, no doubt the city of Denver has a reversionary interest. They had the ownership of this property long before this lease was entered into, and they don't get this reversionary interest by virtue of the financing portions of the lease. They own the ground. They got the reversionary interest by virtue of the fact that they are the city of Denver. They own it. More importantly, HSBC, the man behind the curtain, so to speak, is the party that has no ability to exercise any or have any reversionary interest in the property, even though the facility's rentals are being paid for its sole and exclusive benefit, as the indenture notes. With respect to the typical commercial build-out cases, Westship and Cafe Partners, there's a critical distinction between those cases and ours, which goes to the heart of this entire matter. In those cases, the landlord put up its money or its credit to finance improvements for or by its tenant. And therefore, pardon?
Why? I mean, suppose you have a lease in a new commercial building, and the landlord, that is the owner of the building, borrows money on a non-recourse basis. The lender says the only thing it will look to for payment of the loan, this is the construction lender, says the only thing it will look to for the payment of the loan is the building and the stream of rentals. Do you think that means that now what the tenant has got is partly a real lease and partly construction financing that can be shucked off in bankruptcy?
I would not necessarily say that, Your Honor, but I don't think that
so
that's...
Why is there any difference between what's going on at Denver and what goes on when a brand-new commercial office building is built, where the main security for the construction loan is the anticipated rentals from the tenants?
Well, generally speaking, I think...
And the builder, as I say, on a non-recourse loan, puts up none of its own money.
Well, I think it's just that's a very atypical fact pattern, because I think landlords are generally on the hook either through guarantees or other means for some...
I don't care whether it's typical or not. There are certainly a lot of buildings built with non-recourse loans. I'm asking what you think happens when a new commercial office building is built in the loop with a non-recourse loan.
I would say that depending on the structure, if those assets were available to the lender, available to the landlord, which is not our case here, the assets here are not available to the HSBC. They are not able to do anything but get the facilities rentals to and the extent that United ever pays them. I've not heard of a limited recourse loan where even the property would not be something available for the lender to have at in the non-recourse hypothetical that you put out, Your Honor.
Yes, but the unique feature here and the distinction there is that this is tax-exempt bonds, and the only way they're going to be tax-exempt is to go through this city, whatever you want to call it, entity that, under state law, I guess, can issue tax-exempt bonds. If you went and bought a direct loan, you wouldn't get tax-exempt bonds, and the bond purchaser would have to pay interest on or pay taxes on the interest. Now, I know that's sort of complicated, but it seems to me that's at least a distinction here
And this separate facilities lease does focus on the bondholder getting tax-free income.
And the bondholder gets tax-free income, but the bondholder doesn't get to be a landlord or get the benefits of being a landlord through the guise of the municipality. If, in fact, this was all it took to change the result from the SFO opinion, all SFO would have to have done is, instead of entering into a sub-sublease structure in 1998, simply have an amended and restated lease, and there would simply have to be a change in law to allow the city, that municipality, San Francisco, or L.A., or any other municipality to be the lender.
Well, they'd have to build a whole new airport, which is what Denver did.
That may be, but that doesn't. I'm not sure the fact that they're building an airport has any impact on whether we're talking about a true lease for hired capital, which is, in our view, what this clearly is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. The case is taken under advisement.